everyone. This is Marion from the Talking Information Center, and this is the Salem News for Tuesday, April 7th. The Peabody Veterans Memorial High School will host a Cookiegram fundraiser. A Cookiegram fundraiser in honor of the late Peabody teen Jason Bernard is underway at Peabody Veterans Memorial High School. From March 30th through April 10th, students and staff at the school can purchase cookies baked by the PVMHS Culinary Arts Program for $1 and send them to someone else in the building with one of four messages of kindness. You're appreciated. Be the reason someone smiles today. In a world where you can be anything, be kind. And kindness is free, so pass it on. The proceeds will be split between the class of 2029 and Jason's Legacy Foundation, which was founded by Jason's family to raise money and awareness for suicide prevention after his death last year. Jason was then an eighth grader at the Higgins Middle School, and he died by suicide in May after facing bullying from his classmate, and he was 14 years old. Jason loved to bake cookies in his free time. A cup of laughter, one caring smile, a sprinkle of hope, and a whole lot of love. These are the ingredients we want our students to carry with them, Jason's sister, Sally Rosario, said in a statement from the city. Jay's Cookies is about more than just a sweet treat. It's a reminder to every student to choose kindness every single day. The fundraiser is held in partnership with Jason's Legacy Foundation, the Peabody Public Schools, and Peabody Promise, a citywide mental health initiative to prevent bullying and suicide, as well as spread resources for mental health support that was created following Jason's death. To sponsor a Jay's Cookie, a Recipe for Kindness event in your school or community, you can contact Celie Rosario at jasonslegacy14@gmail.com. Next from Salem, where a survey seeks input on the next school superintendent. The Salem School Committee is inviting community members to share their insights for selecting the next Salem Public School superintendent through an online survey. The survey is intended for students, caregivers, school staff, and community members to provide input and share priorities that the Superintendent Screening Committee and the School Committee should consider in their search for the next leader of the district. The survey, available in English, Spanish, and Portuguese, asks several questions regarding the trajectory of the district and what qualities would be best for the next superintendent. This includes questions about what qualities should be celebrated about Salem Public Schools and what the top challenges are for the district, and what the next superintendent's priorities should be, and what characteristics would be ideal for the next superintendent. The survey is available online now at salem12.org/search, with responses to be submitted no later than Wednesday, April 8th. That's tomorrow. And from the State House, the Senate seeks tax break to spur housing. The State Senate is poised to approve a plan that would authorize tax breaks for affordable housing projects to help spur the development of new multifamily homes. A $1.3 billion supplemental budget teed up for the vote in the Senate next Thursday would divert millionaires' tax proceeds to help fund the state's public transit system, early and special education programs, expanded college financial aid, and tuition repayment programs. But the Senate leaders also tacked on several policy changes to the spending bill, including a proposal to exempt developers of affordable housing projects from the state's 6.25% sales tax for building construction materials. Backers of the plan said it would incentivize production of new, affordable, moderate-income, and middle-income housing units by creating a sales tax exemption for building materials, supplies, and other related costs associated with approved multifamily projects. The sales tax exemption would be capped at $35 million annually. The break would target housing projects in areas with the greatest need, this according to Senate President Karen Spilka's office, requiring at least 15% affordable units in a community where the median income household is 120% of the average household income. By including innovative policy solutions with strong investments in this budget, we're going to be going beyond just allocating funding, said Spilka. We're lowering taxes to spur housing, building our healthcare workforce, and protecting our immigrant neighbors, on top of making generational investments in statewide transit and education. The housing proposal won praise from a commercial real estate industry group, which said it would help keep costs down for new construction, which would in turn help spur development of new projects. Exempting material costs from the state's sales tax will help manage the construction cost volatility facing multifamily housing development in Massachusetts, said Tamara Small. She's the CEO of NAIOP Massachusetts, a commercial real estate development group. From addressing our housing crisis to catalyzing new property tax revenue from municipalities, this is a practical and progressive strategy for the Commonwealth, she said. Beacon Hill leaders are scrambling to boost housing production amid a shortage officials say is affecting the state's economic growth and making it harder to attract new families and businesses. Recent studies cite the lack of housing as the top reason people are leaving the state. Massachusetts has some of the highest housing costs and rents in the country, with the median price of a single-family home hitting a record $610,000 in February, this according to a real estate industry report. Governor Maura Healey, a first-term Democrat, has made housing a key part of her legislative agenda and signed a $5.1 billion housing bill in 2024 that included a mix of bonding, policy changes, tax breaks, and other incentives to help spur the development of new homes. In February, Healey released a five-year Home for Everyone plan with a goal of building 222,000 new housing units over the next decade. The supplemental spending bill is the latest to tap into revenue from the 2022 voter-approved Fair Share Amendment, which set a 4% surtax on incomes larger than $1 million. Under the law, proceeds from the surtax can be spent on transportation or education. State revenue officials say collections from the surtax have exceeded expectations, with $2.5 billion expected to be raised this year. If approved, the Senate's housing plan still faces a long slog through Beacon Hill's lawmaking process. The State House of Representatives passed a $1.8 billion supplemental budget last month, but it didn't include the tax break proposal. That means it would have to be added to the final bill during House and Senate negotiations before heading to Healey's desk for consideration. And still from the State House, congressional candidates tout fundraising hauls. With just 8 months to go until the pivotal midterm elections, Massachusetts voters are beginning to mull over what's expected to be packed into a ballot. There will be a marquee races for governor, a wide-open congressional race in the north of Boston region, a Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate, and a record number of citizen-driven referendums that are also inching toward the November 3rd ballot. Governor Maura Healey, a first-term Democrat, is seeking another 4 years in office amid a challenge from three Republicans. In the 6th Congressional District, 8 Democrats and a Republican are crisscrossing the region to drum up support for their campaigns to replace outgoing Representative Seth Moulton, a 5-term Democrat challenging incumbent Senator Ed Markey in the Democratic primary. Meanwhile, a record 11 state referendums are expected to be put before the voters this November. State House reporter Christian M. Wade is a veteran government and political reporter who has covered Beacon Hill for more than a decade. Over the next several months, he will tag along with campaigns as they stump for support and delve into the issues with candidates to help voters decide. This regular roundup of campaign news will highlight key developments in the races, notable endorsements, campaign fundraising activity, and other milestones ahead of the 2026 elections. Hundreds of thousands of dollars are flowing into the crowded race from the North Shore's congressional seat, with several candidates reporting their latest hauls. Democrat and former Biden administration official Dan Cole said he raised more than $1.5 million in the most recent fundraising quarter that ended March 31st. Cole's campaign says he has raised more than $3.5 million since he launched his bid for the seat last year. He said, I'm asking voters of Massachusetts 6th District to send me to Congress and take the fight directly to Trump and MAGA Republicans who are driving up costs for working families. The support we've built shows that people want leaders who listen first and fight hard. That's how we'll hold Trump accountable and deliver one day one. Democratic State Representative Tram Nugent, also of Andover, said she raised $177,000 in the first quarter of the year and more than $430,000 since she launched her campaign. Her campaign stressed that her contributions came from 1,670 individual donors, with over 83% of all money raised from in-state supporters. Her median contribution cycle to date is below $25, it said. This campaign has always been about showing up in our communities, listening to the concerns of people like me who come from a working class background and depend on each paycheck and earning the trust of voters, she said. Other candidates haven't yet reported their fundraising activity from January 1st through March 31st, and the disclosures aren't due to the Federal Elections Commission until April 15th. Overall, the 6 candidates who reported fundraising activity last year drummed up nearly $4 million collectively as of December 31st. This according to the latest FEC disclosures. If history is any indication, the primary race to succeed Moulton could get expensive. The 2014 race for the 6th Congressional District, the last time the seat was open, was the state's most expensive congressional election that cycle, with more than $10 million spent by candidates and outside groups. A sizable chunk of that money came from political action committees and out-of-state special interest groups. Like early fundraising hauls, political endorsements from labor unions, public interest groups, advocates, elected officials, and even news outlets are another way candidates show early support for their fledgling campaigns. Those endorsements, while not indicative of where the electorate is leaning, can still help candidates, particularly in a crowded primary race such as the 6th Congressional District, and that could be decided by a handful of votes. For campaigns, the hope is that support from a particular group or individual may help sway undecided voters. Winning the backing of labor unions or other groups with large memberships can also mean in-kind fundraising activities, such as door-knocking to phone banking, that can help their campaigns lock down more support for voters. Coe, who narrowly lost a bid for the 3rd Congressional District in 2018 Democratic primary, has been pumping out press releases about his endorsements since he entered the race last year. That includes an endorsement from former Vice President Kamala Harris, which is featured prominently in Coe's fundraising pitches. Dan understands that government should be about delivering for the people, protecting our democracy, standing up to extremism, and making sure families have a fair shot, said Harris in a recent ad. He doesn't chase headlines or shortcuts. He builds coalitions and shows up every single day with integrity and purpose. Nugent has touted endorsements from Democratic legislative leaders, including House Speaker Ron Mariano, but also the Boston Carmen's Union and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 2325, among other labeled unions. The campaign has also gained important momentum through a growing list of endorsements from community leaders, organizations, advocates who recognize Tram's commitment to delivering results, according to the Andover Democrats campaign, said in a statement. Meanwhile, former State Representative Jamie Belsito, who is also seeking a Democratic Party nomination for the 6th Congressional District, has been touting her endorsements from State Auditor Diana DeZeglio, a Methuen Democrat, in her fundraising pitches to supporters. I believe we need a fierce advocate for this district going to D.C. to fight our battles. We have a lot of challenges we're facing. Our democracy is under attack. We need bold, visionary leaders who don't forget where they came from, said DeZeglio. Zaglione statement. The working people of Massachusetts deserve someone who is going to stand up to special interests, she said. Next, we go to Beverly, where a man tried to break into a home on Trafalgar Drive yesterday morning, according to police. The homeowner saw a man he didn't know attempting to open a sliding door of the house with a small knife around 8 a.m. Just as the unknown man was able to get his foot inside the door, the homeowner yelled at him, and the man quickly ran off. Police identified the vehicle the intruder used and have requested a warrant for his arrest. The suspect was not in custody as of 3 p.m. yesterday, according to police, and charges remain pending. At the Salem Athenaeum, which is located at 337 Essex Street, it's a cultural and historical haven, a treasure trove of educational enlightening programs are offered. Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., and on Saturday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And to learn more about their programs, you can call 978-744-2540. Also, Salem Athenaeum is seeking volunteers to join committees and consider serving on the Board of Trustees for Building and Grounds, Collections, Cultural Program, Finance, Patron Engagement, Salem Literary Festival, and the Writers Programs and Specific Events, which is all described on their website. And if you're a local author or illustrator who's published a book within the last 4 years, please consider taking part in sign and several event at Beverly Public Library on Sunday, May 17th. For your book to be considered, you'll need to fill out an online questionnaire and local author registration. You can contact Megan at carasin@noblenet.org. And the Beverly Public Library spring season on Monday mornings is underway. The Monday Mornings Weekly Series is a free program for adults that runs in the spring and fall months at the main library. Programs take place from 9:30 to 10:30. Visit our website and full schedule at beverlypubliclibrary.org. Beverly Library also has plenty going on for you. Visit the main library at 32 Essex Street in Beverly, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. And that's it for local news, so we'll turn to a couple of op-ed pieces from The View. The first one is entitled, Everyone Loses When Journalists Are Hobbled. It hurts to see legendary media destroyed by corporate interference. Two former bastions of journalism, recently taken over by billionaires with a right-wing agenda, are suffering. As the New York Post reported this week, the Washington Post suffered the worst decline in print circulation among the top 25 newspapers in 2025. The decline came ahead of massive layoffs earlier this year, and after its owner, Amazon.com oligarch Jeff Bezos, outraged loyal readers by imposing his viewpoints on the career journalists there. The average daily print circulation of the Washington Post fell 21.2% in the 6 months through the end of September of 2025, down to 87,576 from 111,171 the previous year. This according to a Press Gazette report citing data from the Alliance of Audited Media. Bezos' cancellation of Kamala Harris' endorsement outraged Post readers and his edict that the paper's opinion section emphasize free markets and personal liberties has left that section distrusted by readers and journalists. The Washington Post has long been a beacon of free press imagined by our founders and enshrined by them in the Constitution. It's the heroic entity that stood against the Nixon administration and first published the Pentagon Papers. Now it's owned by a man who wants to make sure his friend Donald Trump is not offended. Rather than let falling numbers teach him a lesson about editorial interference, Bezos and his minions decided that the readers need is what they need is less journalism. Last month, the Post eliminated a third of its newsroom, more than 300 journalists, including the entire sports desk. Yes, just in time for the Olympics, the Bezos crew fired all the sports reporters. They also left fans of the NFL's Washington Commanders, the NBA's Washington Wizards, and the MLB's Washington Nationals with fewer reasons to subscribe or pick up a copy of the Post. Similarly, in television land, CBS News is struggling, largely because its new billionaire owner, David Ellison, installed a right-wing podcaster, Barry Weiss, as editor-in-chief, putting her in charge of journalists whose shoes she is not fit to shine. We're talking about the legendary home of Edward R. Murrow, Walter Cronkite, Mike Wallace, and many more, journalists who fearlessly took on whomever needed taking on. They weren't always liked, but they were always respected by those who respect the truth because their independence and determination delivered to viewers a product that could be trusted. Fast forward to today, when Weiss spiked a 60-minute story the Trump regime didn't like, Weiss' stated reason for her action was that the administration's voice was missing. She ignored the fact that the administration was asked for comment but refused. The story about a brutal Salvadoran prison to which Trump was sending many of the immigrants he has been rounding up eventually aired. Many public backlash was a factor. Maybe public backlash was a factor. Meanwhile, Weiss' leadership of the network's flagship broadcast, CBS Evening News, has been disastrous. The broadcast, once the pulpit of an aforementioned Cronkite, now commands an audience of fewer than 4 million people, less than half that of ABC counterpart, and significantly fewer than the competing NBC broadcast. Things are tough for traditional media these days, but there's still an appetite out there for good information. We need rich people with agendas to get out of the way and let journalists deliver it. Their own bottom lines would be better off if they did. And next, from Still the View by David Mastio, Bondi was the best attorney general we're going to get from Trump. It was obvious what kind of U.S. official Attorney General Pam Bondi would be in the second Trump administration about 12 years before she joined it, long before Donald Trump came down the golden escalator. Bondi took thousands of dollars in Trump campaign donations in 2013 as Florida's Attorney General, and then promptly shut down an investigation of Trump University, then accused of defrauding dozens of state's residents. Someone with the lowest possible opinion of the former Trump defense counsel wouldn't have been disappointed once she became Trump's third state-approved attorney general. She bent and broke the law while abandoning the norm of Department of Justice independence from the White House politics. Such abject obsequiousness wasn't enough for President Donald Trump, who fired her Thursday after barely more than a year in office. When Trump wanted the Epstein files splashed across America's front pages, Bondi promptly promised to release them. When Trump changed his mind after learning of unflattering revelations about himself in the FBI documents, Bondi loyally conspired to hide Trump's role. Her Justice Department broke the law so obviously that even Republican, the wildly partisan House Judiciary Committee, took note. That wasn't her first time, however. Her Justice Department broke the law. Her Justice Department broke the law in deporting people, despite valid and clear judicial orders not to, and lied to dozens of federal judges in the process of pursuing Trump's mass deportation agenda. She and Trump violated the law in handpicking prosecutors to file politically motivated criminal charges against a Democratic New York Attorney General and a Republican former chief of the FBI. Judges promptly slapped that abuse down. Enacting more than Trump's hitman, then disinterested chief law enforcement officer of the nation, no indignity was too great for her to accept. She literally took orders on her department's lawbreaking delivered by Trump's social media messaging app. Her time at the Justice Department included the purge of any FBI agents and prosecutors who had worked on the prosecution of Trump under the previous Democratic administration, which only took up the cases against the then former president after months of trying very hard to avoid it. Literally thousands of professionals involved, along with the civil rights, environmental, and other professional staffers from politically disfavored departments, left. She did not act swiftly to replace them, and as a result, prosecutions by the Department of Justice plummeted. Yes, crime went down under her tenure, as Trump observed, but that was the only continuation of the trend under Joe Biden, which Trump denies ever happened. Trump was frustrated with Bondi because, even as she loyally tried to cover up Trump's involvement with Epstein, facts and documents kept leaking out to the press and congressional Democrats. She was breaking the law, but not enough for Trump. Trump also wanted, frustrated by Bondi's failure, to find a workaround for the grand juries and judges who kept rejecting Trump's efforts to take revenge on his enemies from the Biden years. Again, she broke the law in making illegal appointments to carry out the prosecutions, but she wouldn't overcome override the safeguards in the justice system. The firing of Bondi is a message to all Trump other political appointees, Senate confirmed or not. No amount of bowing to the dear leader is enough. No shredding of your principles is enough. No amount of law-breaking is enough. No amount of humiliation is enough to buy you the loyalty of Donald Trump. You must give him everything he wants, or you'll pay the price. Trump is only loyal to himself. If there is one thing I know after a year of Trump's administration of justice, is that the next attorney general will be worse. That's what it will read on Bondi's political headstone. Here lies the career of Donald Trump's best second-term attorney general. Next, we have an AP story from Washington. The Trump administration is arguing that a judge's order to halt construction of a $400 million ballroom creates a security risk for President Donald Trump as it asks a federal appeals court to pause the ruling. In a motion filed on Friday, National Park Service lawyers say that the federal judge's order to suspend construction of the new facility is threatening grave national security harms to the White House, the president, his family, and the president's staff. Time is of the essence, the lawyers write, citing materials that will be installed to make a heavily fortified facility. The ballroom construction also includes bomb shelters, military installations, and a medical facility, according to the filing. The ballroom is part of President Donald Trump's plan to quickly remake Washington. U.S. District Judge Richard Leon on Tuesday, ordered a temporary pause of the construction project that is including demolishing the east wing of the White House. He'd concluded that unless Congress approves the project, the preservationist group suing to stop it is likely to succeed on the merits of its claims because no statute comes close to giving the president the authority he claims to have. The judge suspended enforcement of his order for 14 days, acknowledging that the administration would appeal his decision. Leon's ruling and the appeal came the same week a key agency tasked with approving the construction of federal property in Washington region gave final approval to the project. In his ruling, Leon, who was nominated by Republican President George W. Bush, suspended enforcement of his order, recognizing that halting an ongoing construction project may raise logistical issues. Leon also addressed national security in his ruling, saying that he reviewed the information that the government privately submitted to him and concluding that halting construction would not jeopardize national security. He exempted any construction work that is necessary for the safety and security of the White House from the scope of injunction. Trump lashed out at the ruling, but also noted that it would allow work on underground bunkers and other security measures around the White House grounds to continue, even though those will be paid for by taxpayers. Trump has pledged that he, along with private donors, will cover the costs of the ballroom construction. But the National Park Service argues in its motion that the president has complete authority to renovate the White House and the current state of the grounds, which is an open construction site, make it harder to protect the White House. Canvas tents, which are necessary without a ballroom, are significantly more vulnerable to missiles, drones, and other threats than a hardened national security facility, the motion says. The Trump administration is asking the appeals court to make a decision on its request by Friday. It also leaked that the 14-day suspension of Leon's order be extended by another 2 weeks so that the case can be taken to the Supreme Court. The ruling and the appeal came the same week a key agency tasked with approving such projects gave its final approval. And that's a wrap for this Salem News for Tuesday, April 7th. Thank you so much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you all have a great day.